Well, I've been looking at this table here, and I have absolutely no idea what our brother's going to talk about this morning. But I know that the Lord has placed a message upon his heart. That's obvious. And I pray that you'd lift him up in your silent prayers and also ourselves, that we would be open and receptive to the message that the Lord has. I give it to you, our apostle, Brian McIndoe.
Thank you, Ken. I'm going to talk about blessed be the nation whose God is the Lord. Does that sound as bad to you as it does to me? Well, keep working. I know you can't do anything while I'm not talking, can you? But I'm not going to talk like this all day. I sound like a chipmunk or something. And I don't want to sound like a chipmunk. I'm happy to be here with you. This will be the last Sunday I will be with you for a few weeks, hopefully only a few weeks, a few months, and then I'll be back in your presence. Are you getting any better? Do I need to swap mics?
Does it sound better or we want to change? Good?
Sounds good? Okay. I don't want you falling asleep on me. I thought of a sermon 2 weeks ago, actually, two Sundays ago today. After church, I went home and began working on a sermon. And you know, problem with that is you got a lot of time to add to your sermon when you have that. And then I was amazed today when I came to church of the subject of our Sunday school. But I'm going to begin in Isaiah chapter 45. And I'm going to read one verse. In fact, today, I'm only going to read 35 verses. Not 35 chapters, not 35 pages. 35 verses. Not references. Just verses. And I want you to try to do something that is better than what I can do. Okay? I try not to have long readings when I'm preaching, because I know for myself, when somebody starts reading this big, long, you know, 97 verses of Scripture, about a third of the way through it, start looking at the little kids, start thinking about something else, you know, I don't really know, you know, I know the gist of this verse, but what point was he really trying to hammer there? That's me. Maybe that's not you. But when I'm preaching, I got seven verses there. And I mean, when I'm preaching and I'm reading those verses, I mean, they just make perfect sense. I mean, they're just like pictures forming in my mind. And then I'm thinking, there's no pictures forming in the minds out there, because they're looking at the kids and they're thinking about what's for lunch and what's that smell and something burning in the stove in the back and stuff. So what I'm going to ask you is not to be like me. I tried to keep everything as short as possible. If possible, try to follow along with these verses that I tried to keep short. Think about them. Picture them in your mind. I will try to point out exactly what it is I'm trying to get you to receive out of these verses. I'll try to punctuate these thoughts, and I'll keep the verses short. I didn't say I'll keep the sermon short. I said I'll keep the verses short. And we'll begin. One verse, Isaiah chapter 45, verse 18. It says, "For thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it, he hath established it. He created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else." You know, that's some controversial stuff in this world that we live. You know, we just heard a song, "Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord." But when you go out there and you start talking to everybody out there in this world that we live in, this nation that we live in, and you say, there's a God who created the heavens and the earth. He formed the earth. He formed it to be inhabited by his special creation, which is mankind. that they might serve him. And there is one and only one God, and there is none else. You better be ready, because that's not going to be the end of the conversation in most of your circles. That is controversial type of subject. At work, amongst your friends, in the classroom. They don't just really want to believe that statement there, as Isaiah had told us. What motivated my sermon for today is the season we're in. What season are we in? Hot season, yeah. What comes at the very end of the hot season? Monsoon, that's not it either. Okay, let's think about the commercials. What is everybody trying to say? Back to school. Okay, here we are. This is back to school time. We're going back to school. Some of us will actually be going to schools, public schools, interfacing with people with all different ideas. Some of us will be going to colleges, some high schools, some grade schools. Are you ready? I heard Brother Andrew last Wednesday or the Wednesday before stand up and say, I got to go back to school, you know. I got to face these challenges. I hope I'm strong. Faces the challenges of these instructors that will be making me sit there and listen, and I won't be able to speak back. Are you ready to face the challenges to your faith, your beliefs, that, or some of these things may surface when you study, your scientific manuals and your math and stuff. Parents, are you ready when your child comes home and says, my teacher said, are you ready to tell them the truth about God and about the subject which you're learning in school? Homeschoolers, you're not exempt from this. You're going to have to learn certain things. Homeschool teachers, are you ready to explain science and your science curriculums and know how these things that your books and your curriculums are going to tell you, how they relate to this God that formed the earth and there's only one God? You know, I heard just a few days ago that there's been an Arizona law passed that is going to require students to take more science and more math classes to graduate from high school. We as a people, the body of people in Arizona, have decided our students need to be more scientifically educated, more math knowledge. And if they can't do it, they can't get out of high school, which means maybe some more challenges for you. So you're sitting there thinking, well, I'm not a school. I'm not a home teacher. I'm not a parent. My kid is already, you know, 50 years old. I'm sorry for you people. We'll all be there. But everyone has to be prepared to hear the lies of Satan, the deceptions of Satan, the twisted truth of Satan from the scholarly men and women of this world. And you have to be ready to confidently tell yourself that they have been deceived and you know the truth. You know, if you watch television, if you watch any of these shows like on Discovery and stuff, there's all kinds of things that are twisted that come and they challenge your knowledge. They challenge the beliefs that you have. I can't help but be marveled. I thought I was going to stand up here today and say, show you my little spread here and say, I can guarantee you, I can't say anybody has preached my sermon. And then Gordon got up in Sunday school, and he really has talked a lot about my sermon today. So I guess, you know, you just don't say that. You know, when the Lord works, the Lord works. And now I feel a little bit more inspired by what I was given 2 weeks ago. But let's look at Revelation chapter 12, verse 9. It says, and the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Satan was cast out of heaven. He is here to deceive us. I like some of the comments that were talked about in our Sunday school lesson, that the devil wants to captivate us. He wants to capture us. He wants to steal us. He wants us to bring us down to be miserable like unto himself. And to do it, he is going to use his tools. And his tools, most of his tools, involve the weaknesses of man. Our own weakness. Are you going to use ourselves against us? You know, I understand why he would do that. Because it's the easiest way. When I was a detective for the police department, and I would have to interrogate a suspect, I would prey upon his weaknesses, the same weaknesses of pride and arrogance and knowledge, to get him to want to tell me that he committed a crime. Because that is a weakness of man. Man has this weakness for knowledge. He has a weakness of pride. He has a weakness for power. He has a weakness for pleasure. And when Satan says, I'm going to give you these things. I'm going to give you knowledge. I'm going to give you power, because knowledge comes power. I'm going to give you pleasure. I'm going to make you better than someone else, stronger than someone else, more learned than someone else. I'm going to lift you up. Our impulse is to say, give me. I want it. I want it. And so that's what Satan plays upon. And God has cast him to this earth, and he's here trying to captivate us. So let me ask you, do you think it's impossible for you to fall into that trap of man's arrogance? Do you think it's impossible that Satan's trap of pride and arrogance is not there trying to get you? The impulse of human wisdom says it is. It's there, lurking at the door, wanting to capture you at any given moment, at any spot possible. Satan in the garden, remember the first temptation was, you will be like God. Man, that hits on pride, that hits on knowledge, that hits on power. It hits on all those things. Yeah, I want to be like God. I want to be a god of my own world. Sure. And that caused the original fall, the original sin. It's common belief today in this world that man is the most learned creature in this universe. The universe centers around man. There is nothing higher than a human being. It is becoming a very popular idea. Are you strong enough to be different? Are you strong enough to stand when people look at you and laugh at you and scoff at you and call you ignorant because you believe in a more powerful entity, that you believe in God, a God in heaven that you cannot see, that you cannot grasp your hands upon, that you cannot completely and fully explain everything about him. I want to call your attention to my longest reading. It's 7 verses. And I want you, if you, at all possible, open your books and follow along with me. I know this is a very common story. It was a common story for me, too. And then something jumped out of it, you know, like 40 years after I've read it from the first time. And then some new jumped out of it. And I'd like to call your attention to that. 1 Nephi chapter 2. I'm going to read verse 65 through 76. And this is Lehi's vision. Remember Lehi's vision? Where he saw a tree, he saw a river, he saw a path, he saw a rod of iron, he saw a great and spacious building. He got to the tree, he was there, he saw a fruit that was whiter than any other fruit, sweeter than any other fruit, and that fruit was the love of God. And he beckoned his family, come, partake of this fruit with me. He beckoned his friends and those that were with him to come and partake of this fruit. And in this vision, we see what Lehi saw, beginning in verse 65. And I saw numberless concourses of people, many of whom were pressing forward, that they might obtain the path which led unto the tree which I stood. And it came to pass that they did come forth and commence in the path which led to the tree. And it came to pass there arose a mist of darkness, which is temptations and trials and things of this earth, yea, and even exceeding great mist of darkness, insomuch that they who were commenced in the path did lose their way, that they wandered off and were lost. And it came to pass that I beheld others pressing forward, and they came forth and caught hold of the end of the rod of iron, and they did press forward through the midst of the darkness, clinging to the rod of iron. What is a rod of iron? I'm not going to talk about that much. It's the word of God. The path is that brings you to the tree of life. They're hanging on to that rod of iron. They got through the midst of darkness. They're headed for the tree. And they did press forward through the midst, clinging to the rod of iron, even until they came forth to partake of the fruit of the tree. They reached it. They were there. They got there. They partook of the love of God. I hope that's the case for us in this room right here. We've taken the word of God. We've got our feet on the path. We're tasting the love of God, his blessings upon our life. Verse 70, and after they had partaken of the fruit of the tree, after they were there, they did cast their eyes about, as if they were ashamed. And I also cast my eyes around about and beheld on the other side of the river of water a great and spacious building. And it stood as if it were in the air, high above the earth. And it was filled with people, both old and young, both male and female. And their manner of dress was exceedingly fine. And they were in the attitude of mocking and pointing their fingers towards those that had come, who had come at and were partaking of the fruit. This is the world. They're going to mock. They're going to point. They're going to scoff at you. They're going to laugh at you because you are believing in the love of God and the truth of the scriptures. And you've clung to the rod of iron. You've reached this point. When you look around, there are going to be those people there. But in verse 76, here are the people that have partaken of the fruit. It says, and after they have tasted of the fruit, they were ashamed because of those that were scoffing at them. And they fell away into forbidden paths and were lost. Just because you made it this far does not mean that you can't look at the world and not be strong and fall away into forbidden paths. Satan is still trying to capture you. At every corner, at every weakness you have. And this parable tells us that there were those that reached that point and then they departed. Unfortunately, we know some that were in our midst that are not with us today. They were here. They were partaking of the love of God, and they have departed. They were ashamed of the truth. Nephi explained this vision to his brothers in his vision. And he says in 1 Nephi 3:93, He says, and it came to pass that I saw and bear record that the great and spacious building, remember that building? It contained, those people were pointing their finger and mocking and ridiculing and laughing at those in the church. That great and spacious building was the pride of the world. Pride. The world has pride. Why do we have pride? We have pride because we think we have knowledge. We know what the universe involves. We know the truths today. And therefore, if you believe in something you can't explain, you're just ignorant. The pride of the world. You know, this is not the only place. Well, I got a lot of scriptures that the people in the New Testament had to deal with this same issue of pride. They were dealing in a time where there were scholars, you know, there were scholarly men sitting around in schools learning things, learning great things about the universe and about science. And they had pride. We know that man has advanced. Man has advanced, and he has a wealth of knowledge. We have accomplished many things. We can explain many things about the world in which we live. And I think this has caused some people to think that they no longer need to believe in a God because they can explain all these things of the earth. Not much difference. Not really a lot different than the days of advancement in the Bible, the Old Testament time, where man began to be lifted up in his pride. He began being advanced in knowledge. And what did they do? The Lord says, go out, multiply, fill this earth. And they all came together after the days of Noah. They built a tower in the land of Babel. And they said, we're going to build this massive tower to reach up and reach the heavens to see God with our own eyes. Some commentators, and I'm not sure I disagree with them, believe that what they were really saying is, God, we're going to build a tower so high that if you ever try to destroy us with a flood again, that you won't be able to. It's the pride, the same kind of pride that the people that built the Titanic says, this ship cannot be sunk. God himself can't sink this ship. It never made it to the next port. And God himself can't do it. We're going to reach up to heaven and we'll look God in the face. No, they didn't. Man lifts himself up in pride and the Lord has to put his thumb on him and bring them back down. We're getting there. We're getting very close to that. I'm waiting for the day that the Lord is going to have to humble us. But truth is, God has given us, people, human beings, a brain. We are different than anyone else, any other creature on this earth. I'm sitting there studying my dogs last night. I got these two little dogs. They were almost the same age. They were born at the same kennel. They've been together all their life. And they just love each other. I mean, they are together all the time. They're laying on each other. They're playing and tumbling and rolling around. And they never have a problem. Now, I was thinking about that, you know. I thought, you know, if dogs could talk, I know this dog would be telling that dog, you know, that's disgusting and don't do that. That dog would get mad at this dog or they would go to two separate rooms and lay down. But they don't do that, you know. One dog can go outside and eat some disgusting thing and the other dog will come in and start chewing on its mouth. And, you know, they don't argue with things. They don't have that ability to talk and communicate. We smart people do that and then we end up fighting with our wives and our husbands and our children and things like that because we're so advanced. But God has given us this knowledge. He's given us this ability to learn and to understand and to improve. Improve our lives. Improve the conditions in which we live by our learning, by our advancement. It's a gift from God. I remember when I was in school, I know that was a long time ago, but I remember it. God's given us a brain that we can remember things till we get a certain age, and then we start forgetting them. But I was in school, and when I was in school, they, especially math class, you know, they start teaching you things like formulas and, you know, and, you know, I never took chemistry because I couldn't ever understand algebra. Because they're teaching you all these formulas, but they didn't give you any practical application for them. My teachers, maybe yours did, my teachers never told me why I needed to understand something, how I would put it into use. How these formulas and understanding how to work these mathematical equations or these geometry or this trigonometry or algebra or anything, how that was going to be put into practical use in my lifetime. Didn't do it. Didn't understand it. I figure now, you know, I got a lot of hobbies now. I like to do carpentry work, build cabinets and that type of thing. You know, I have to do a lot of that stuff that they were trying to teach me. I had to kind of teach myself, and I don't know what it is I'm doing, if it's geometry, trigonometry, chemistry, geology, I don't know. But I have to do it. I like to cook. You know, baking is a science. Just browning a hamburger, there's a scientific principle behind that. You know, I took a lot of science subjects in school, but I didn't continue because I was bored. Nobody gave me practical applications. You know, you get to earth science, and they start talking about sedimentary layers. So you get out your textbook and you read, you know, five chapters of sedimentary layers. I did the same thing, you know. My theory is if your eyes look at the word, you've read it. You can think about what you want at the same time, but, you know, you just got to do this. You know, would it kill the teacher to take in a jar of rocks and sand and dirt and shook it up and water and shook it up and set it down and let us watch sedimentary layers develop? Would it have killed him to do that? Nah, it wouldn't have, but he didn't do it. Didn't do it. So all I got to do is read about sedimentary layers. And then years later, we're driving to Grand Junction, Colorado, through Utah, and here's all these layers of ground standing sideways, and your kids start asking you questions. Well, how did that get like that, Dad? I don't know. I didn't pay attention in school. Where was I? Oh, okay. You know, it would be nice. You know, we learn things. We get old. Now, I really wish I could go back to school and learn some of these things. 2 weeks ago, at the beginning of this sermon, I was laying in bed. It's 2:40 a.m. in the morning. I just gone to bed. And I'm laying there, and I am trying to calculate the square root of 32. Anybody want to give me the answer? There might be something out there that's smart. I think. Remember, I said I didn't pay attention. I think that's how you do it. Is that how you do it? Square root of 32. It's a long story why I chose 32. It was because I didn't do my math right. I started at 4 and 16, then I doubled 16 and got 32 instead of square root and all this stuff. But I laid there for hours trying to figure it out. I didn't figure it out. I knew it was between 5 and 6. If you really care. I took a calculator and a lot of time. It's 5.659, and that's still not exactly the square root of 32. That's actually 32.024. But I have no idea what the formula is. You know, my formula is, well, try 6. Well, that's bigger than 32. Try 5. Well, that's smaller than 32. It's somewhere in between, you know. I just multiply. There's got to be a formula for it. But what are these formulas? Do we know them? Are we prepared for them? There's a lot of subjects like that. A lot of subjects just like this math subject that we need to know, that the world knows, that it benefits us. Science is one of them. I love science, but I was disappointed that the teachers did not let us discover it hands-on. Didn't let us do the experiments and see the proof of it and see that it works. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit about science. I'm going to talk about science, and I'm going to talk about science and its relationship to God. Because science and knowledge that comes with science is one of those things that Satan is using as a tool. As a tool to take man's pride and take him and rip him out of the grips of the fingers of God. To pull him out of the truth of the plan of salvation. To deceive him, to think there is no God, there is no need of God, that man can understand all things. Some of you may think that when we talk about God and science, that it's a conflict, it's contradictory in terms, but it's not. It's not. Science is a subject. It shouldn't be confusing. It shouldn't frustrate us. It should not alienate us from the plan of salvation. There is science. We live in a world of science. We benefit by science. But what is science's relationship to God? And there's many misconceptions. I got a lot of stuff up here. And I'm going to do a lot of things with it. This is ice water. I'm going to pour this ice water in a cup. I'm going to take a drink. That's all the cups up there for. I just thought it'd be fun if it had ice water there. I'm going to do a scientific experiment. Didn't even know this science existed. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this is a regular old dime. This is a regular 3x5 card. And I'm going to trace out this dime onto this 3x5 card. There it is, traced out. And I'm going to cut that dime-sized hole out of this card. I'm going to bend it in half to make that easier. And we'll just cut out a dime-sized hole real quickly here. One dime-sized hole in a 3x5 card, right? Anybody disagree with that? Can you put this quarter through that dime-sized hole without tearing this card? Huh? Anybody want to try? There's a science called topology, I think is what it's called. If you just pull those corners up, there it goes. I didn't tear the card. Science, topology, the study of shapes. Before this sermon's over, I am going to put a man through this card. I am a man. I was going to put me, but I'm not sure I can do it with my tie on. I may use Andrew. I may try myself. I will put a man through the card without ripping it. Science. Don't take my quarter, Ken. It's science. It's called topology. It is a study. Let's see if I got a better definition. The study of shapes and surfaces. Do you think that benefits us? I mean, how many of us go around? I mean, a good trick at a party, right? But this is a study of shapes and surfaces. And it's important because this study of shapes and surfaces is all around us. It changes our lives. You use it every day and probably don't even know it. How many times do you use topology in a day? Anybody know? A lot. I'm here to tell you. We cannot dismiss science. We can't dismiss it as nonsense because we're prideful, because prideful men has misused it to try to take us away from God. Science is a part of our life. It's improved our life. I'm going to give you another experiment, how topology affects us in our normal day. This is a regular $1 bill. Anybody disagree with me, give me one of your own dollars, and I will put mine in my pocket. I see no takers. I'm going to set that across those two books. It creates a bridge, doesn't it? But I want that dollar bill to support this quarter. Didn't do it. Okay, I dropped it from too high. Let me try it down lower. It won't do it. So, any of you out there have a stronger dollar bill that I can create a bridge with? Oh, I'm a quarterback. It's not that I don't trust Ken. I need it. Anybody have a stronger dollar bill? Okay, well, let's use this one. Let's make this one into a bridge. Simple topology. All I'm going to do is fold it. Accordion. Back and forth, one way or the other. I just made a little accordion out of it. One way and the other. Set it across there. There's my quarter. It's holding just fine. There are six more quarters, holding just fine. I threw that one off. It didn't break the bridge. I just slipped. It holds over 10 quarters. All because this corrugation of a dollar bill. Okay, another parlor trick? No. How do we use that? Bridges use this technology so that you can drive your cars over them. You ever get a cardboard box in the mail? A layer of paper, corrugated paper, just like that dollar bill, another layer of paper. It makes that cardboard strong. Topology, a science. We use it. It's part of our life. We do it every day. I'm putting my dollar in my pocket. It is there. It's a part of us. Science is a part of our world, and it's all around us. I looked at Webster's New World Dictionary for the definition of science. It says the state or fact of knowledge. Systemized knowledge derived from observation, from study, from experimentation carried on in order to determine the nature or principle of what is being studied. Any branch of scientific knowledge, one concerned with establishing, systemizing facts, principles, and methods, as by experiment and hypotheses, the science of mathematics. And so it's saying, in science, you have hypotheses. You think this is what's going to happen. Does it happen? You use experiments to see if you're right, to determine if these facts are right. The definition continues on. It says, systemized knowledge of nature and the physical world, such as natural science, defined as systemized knowledge of nature, the physical world, including zoology, botany, chemistry, physics, geology. So science is a fact. It is a fact. It is all around us. There is something to it. It does exist. Science is what we know because we have studied it. We have tried it. We have experimented with it, and we have proved it. We have proved it to be true. And true science, conclusions are based solely upon the facts that can be supported by experimentation. What's an experiment? It means you try it out. You recreate it and see if it works. And if it's scientifically correct and it's true, it will constantly demonstrate and reproduce the principle that you thought it would do. Now, these studies, these experiments, these ideas are interpreted by human beings and our human minds and our human reasons. So there is possibilities for errors. But that's why you keep experimenting. You keep trying it. And you come up with your best idea of this scientific fact. Some things are pretty easy. Some things are pretty simple. We know them to be true. They're scientific facts. If we do it over and over again, it will happen. Let's try another experiment, shall we? This time, I have a golf ball. You ready for the experiment? There it is. Tough, huh? It's called gravity. Scientific fact. Golf ball will always have gravity. What is gravity? Webster's New World Dictionary. It says forces that tend to draw all bodies to the Earth's sphere towards the center of the Earth. I could drop the book. I could drop myself. I could drop anything. It's going to go towards the center of the Earth. That's gravity. It works every time. But it still hasn't hit the center of the Earth, has it? Why? Because there's more to that science. Until it's met by an opposing force that is stronger than the gravitational pull. In this case, it was either my hand, the table, the floor. It was always going down, but there's an opposing force. But until it hit that opposing force, it was going towards the center of the Earth. So you ask me, well then, Brian, why would a helium balloon float? It's not going towards the center of the Earth. And the answer is scientific. It's because it has been met by an opposing force. The opposing force was air. Helium is lighter than air, so it goes up because the air is the opposing force. What do you mean, lighter than air? Lighter than air? There's air weighs something. I don't know what's air. Let me get you a couple pounds of air up here and put it on the table. You know, I mean, it doesn't seem like air has weight, but it does. It does. The air that we have all around us has 14, let me write this down. pounds of pressure per square inch. That's what air weighs at sea level. We're actually 1,000 feet above sea level, so it's a little less than that. All the atmosphere above us, all the way down to the sea, exerts 14.7 pounds of pressure per square inch. That means that's a square inch. Everywhere there's that much surface space, there's that much weight. On your body, every square inch has 14.7 pounds of pressure. There is thousands and thousands of pounds forcing down upon your body right now. You don't feel it because, and the reason you don't implode and get crushed is because your body has external forces equalizing, pressurizing outward, and it keeps you intact. Your muscles are strong enough that when you go like this, it's not like lifting 14 pounds. But if you do this long enough, you're going to start feeling them, 14 pounds of air. Because it's there. 14.7 pounds of air. And so you do not deflate yourself. Now, I tell you that. The scientists tell us that. But if that were true, we should be able to prove that by experimentation. You don't have to tell me there's 14.7 pounds of air. You know, I don't feel it. I don't weigh it. I've never been to outer space to see the difference. And so they should be able to prove that. And so we're going to do another experiment. Because I tell you know, that there's air out there and it has weight. We're going to do another experiment. And I know this is what you all have been waiting for. That's it right there. And I've been racking my brain to how I want to describe this so that you understand it. What we need to do is to prove that there's 14.7 pounds of air on us. And every square inch, I lost my inch, bright pink, and there it is, 14.7 pounds per square inch. Why? This is a standard issue aluminum can. If there's 14.7 pounds per square inch on this aluminum can, why isn't that collapsed and crushed? Well, the reason is because it's open. When it wasn't open, there was liquid in there that was producing more force on the outside, and it kept it from crushing in. They left a little air space in there to equalize pressure if it swelled or contracted. But now it's not collapsing as we look at it because it's got a hole in the top of it. And their air is going inside. There's 14.7 pounds per square inch all along the inside of this can. And so there's 14.7 pounds per square inch on this can on the outside, that much on the inside. So in a scientific principle, if somehow we could seal up this can and instantly take all of the air out of this can, 14.7 pounds per square inch would hit this can. And what would you think would happen? Let's do some math before we do that. This can is per square inch. You got to figure out how many inches this can is. This can is 4 inches tall. Okay? Takes four of these. 1, 2, 3, 4 of them to get to the top of this can. It is 8 inches in circumference. Not to be confused with radius, it's the distance around the can. 8 inches, 4 by 8. Somebody that's in school this year, tell me what that number equals. Zachary? Cody, I'm sorry. 32, great. Okay, 32 times 14.7. One of you homeschool teachers or other teachers, tell me what that number is. .4. If I could take all of the equalizing pressure out of this can, 470.4 pounds would be crushing down upon it. What is your theory would happen to this can if all of a sudden 470 pounds immediately hit this can? What would happen to it? Anybody have a theory? Zachary? It would crush. Any other theories? You all agree with Zachary? Shake your heads like this if you do. Okay, we're all on the same page. We all have the hypotheses if we could just take this air, this can out, all the air out of this can, and seal it up so air can't come back in, it would crush because there's 470.4 pounds being laid on it. So, we're going to try an experiment to see if we can accomplish that. And all I'm going to do here is I'm going to put about a tablespoon of water in this can. And that was more than a tablespoon. And I'm going to light this with a little luck. Dwayne, is the insurance paid up on the church? You know, I'm bound and determined to beat the watermelon roll and the jar toss. One of these days, I will do it. I'm working at it very hard. Andrew assures me that this white flame is going to go down here in a minute. It's going to get real hot. What I'm going to do is I'm going to set this on this can on there. And all I'm accomplishing there is I'm going to bring the water that is put in there to a boil. When that comes to a boil, it's going to generate steam. Steam is vaporized molecules of water. And they are going really fast. They're agitated. They're jumping up and down. You just put a fire under their feet. And they take up more pressure, more room than the air that is in that can. And so what's going to happen is when they start taking up all that they room in that can, they're going to press the air that's 14.7 pounds. They're just going to push it right out because they're so excited and so agitated, they're just taking it all out. It actually creates more pressure than that. Pretty soon, after it's pushed all the air out, it's going to build up pressure, and steam is going to start coming out of the top of here because there's not enough room in this can for it. Another scientific principle, that's where we came up with locomotives and steam engines and boilers and stuff like that. They harness power from steam. And so what I did, what we will do is these molecules of water, of vapor, they're so excited and so agitated, they take up a lot of room. But I only put a tablespoon of water in there. So that one tablespoon of water is going to turn into vapor and it's going to take up all the room in that can. In fact, some of it's going to disappear. And there will be no air in there. There's only going to be the tablespoon of water. Unfortunately, it's all in vapor. It's all in steam. It's all taking up more room than the can, and it's going to come out of here. So if I hear it come, you see the steam starting to come? If I took this can off and I just set it here, when that water starts to cool, that steam starts to cool, part of it's already escaped, it's just going to condense right back down, make a little pool of water down at the bottom of that can, and all that air is going to come back in there. And it's not going to do anything. So what we have to do to prove that there is pressure all around us is what we have to do is figure out a way to cool that water, that steam, that vapor, back into water really quick. And at the same time, keep any air from going back into that can. That's all we got to do. If we can do that, we should be able to demonstrate what Zach said, that that can is going to crush because there's 470 pounds, just 470 pounds of pressure hitting on that can. So my theory is, if I take some ice water, nice cold ice water, tastes good too. That will cool it down really fast. Now all I got to do is keep the air from going back in it. So I'm going to put it in upside down. Seal off that hole with the ice water. The cold water will hit that can. All that vapor is going to turn right back into water. And if Zach's right, this can's going to crush. Let's just see what happens. Pounds of pressure hit that immediately. The experiment worked. It works every time. Over and over and over, we can prove it. Why is it not completely flat? Topology. That's a sharp surface. It's hard to crush that now. It's got a different shape, shapes and surfaces. But that crushed a can very well. You know, I can see some of you young men trying to think of what you can do to your mother's tea kettles now to see how strong they really are, you know. But it's a science. It's a science that we can prove. It's a science that's there. It tells us what's going to happen. If you can prove it, you can prove there's 14.7 pounds. It is science. It is scientific fact. But if you cannot prove it, if you say there's something that we need to explain, but there is no proof for it, there's no way we can prove it, then it doesn't become scientific fact. It becomes what's known as a theory. A theory. A scientific theory. Webster defines a theory as general principles of a subject, plausible or scientifically acceptable explanation, judgment, guess, opinion, a hunch, a suspicion, an assumption, a belief, a feeling, a notion. Keep that in mind when you hear this word in your classrooms, when you hear this word in the world. Well, the theory is, this scientific theory, that these are hunches. They're feelings. They're notions. These are scientific explanations, not scientific facts. You know, one such theory, they almost have dropped the word theory, is evolution. But evolution was an evolutionary theory, an evolutionary scientific explanation, a guess, a hunch. Vertical evolution, what I mean by vertical is man evolving upward from a lesser creature to a more advanced creature, from pond scum to man, does not fit science. You cannot duplicate it. They cannot set up here in front of you like I just did, crushing the can, and duplicate it. It's a theory. It's a hunch. And it's one of the most rigid and uncompromising laws in nature that scientists will tell you about is the fixicity. Fixicity means they're fixed. Of species. Species can't go from one species to the other. They know, they have proven, they have studied, they've seen, they can show it over and over again, that a species has uniqueness about it. The chromosomes are unique, and they prevent any change, any reaction. Every species, every genera, meaning biological class, has its own set of chromosomes, its own number and size and assortment of chromosomes, and they differ between every different species. Thus, apes and man, although we're all basically the same family of hominids, we're all that same family, but we are not the same. We cannot produce offspring together. It's impossible. It does not happen because that would be vertical evolution. It'd be changing a new species, and it's an impossibility. The scientists know it, but yet there's their theory of evolution to gone from pond scum to move upward to the intelligence of man. And their own scientific facts tell him that can't happen. So it's only a theory. It's only a scientific explanation. Horizontal evolution, which I mean along the same species line, not changing the species, but staying right in the same species line, that's possible. And we see it happen all the time. We see it in breeding. You breed dogs, you create a new dog, you know. But it's not a new species. We see it in extinction. We sometimes see it in mutation, but mutations does not fit science. We never see a mutant or an offspring from a crossbreed or a crossbred line turn into another species. You take a Labrador and a poodle, you get a Labradoodle. You don't get a new creature. It is still a dog. A cockapoo is still a dog. And when you take a mutation, Almost all mutations, they're caused by some element that's out there, radiation or some other thing. A mutation that comes from it is always an inferior creature with defects. It's never improved. Spider-Man does not happen. It doesn't happen. And so these theories that they come and tell you with are not fact. They are theories. Sometimes these explanations, these theories that are given to us by man and by science, sometimes these explanations are not acceptable to the believer. And it's okay. You do not have to accept it. You need to understand, this is a theory. It is your best guess. I have a different theory. I have a different guess. I have evidence for my guess. I do not have to accept it. Theories such as evolution, the guess of evolution, the hunch of evolution, to me sounds more like the definition of science fiction. Webster's Worldwide Dictionary describes science fiction as fiction of a highly imaginative or fantastic kind, typically involving some actual or projected scientific phenomenon. You know, it really fits that description. So today, we live in a realm of this physical world. God has placed principles for us in this world. He's put them in motion. He uses them. They have been here for the benefit of man. They've been here for the existence of man. Scientists have studied and began to understand them, begin to explain them, begin to teach it to us that we might know them. But God did not say to use the scientific principles of the earth to define him or to understand him. That's not what he told us to do with it. Science of this world, defined and understood by mortal men, does not define God. Rather, science reflects. It reflects the very existence of God, a great and grand creator of this earth, who set all these things into motion, put all these things into existence for our benefit, that we might live comfortably and adequately upon this earth. He's given us a brain so we can observe and understand these things and put these principles into use for our own desires and our own uses, for our own comfort, for our own health. I think about the story when Korihor was teaching the people, there is no God, and he was brought before judgment. And in Alma chapter 16, verse 54 and 55, they told Korihor, they said, the scriptures are laid before thee, yea, and all things denote there is a God, yea, even the earth, and all things that are upon the face of it, yea, and its motion, yea, and all the planets which move in their regular form, does witness that there is a supreme creator. And yet do you go about leading away the hearts of this people, testifying unto them there is no God. And yet will you deny against all these witnesses? Man tried to create an ecosystem here in Arizona, in Tucson, a perfect ecosystem, a perfect world. It sustained itself. It created its own water, its own oxygen. They created their own food, a small biosphere, just like the world. It lasted for 2 years, and they had to pump air into it. They couldn't do it, but God has let it happen for thousands of years. There is a creator that keeps everything in perfect harmony for us. So science does not define God. It reflects God's power and that he exists. Nor is God confined to these laws of nature. I noticed that tomorrow night on History International Channel, they are going to have a special. They are going to show you the science that underlines the story of Moses. It may or may not. We'll explain to you how all these miracle things happened when Moses departed out of Exodus. But if there's something they can't explain, they'll have to make it up or say, well, that part didn't happen. Are you going to let that define God? Is God confined to only the things that we can explain? No. We don't understand all the nature of God. He is not confined to only those things which our brain can understand and can explain and comprehend. I'm going to read Jacob chapter 3, verses 9 through 11. It says, behold, great and marvelous are the works of the Lord. How unsearchable are the depths of the mysteries of him. And it is impossible that man should find out all his ways. And no man knoweth his ways, save it be revealed unto him. Wherefore, brethren, despise not the revelation of God. In the Bible, Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9, says, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than yours, and my thoughts than your thoughts. We cannot try to define or confine God to the realm of things we understand. But he has placed them here, and they reflect his great power and his great existence. We live in a world today where even the so-called theologians, the religious scholars, are denying the very miracles that are spoken of in the Bible, reported by the witnesses of those who were there. They're denying the virgin birth because they can't explain it. They're denying the raising of the dead. They're denying the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the resurrection of mankind. They're denying that he ever rose from the dead or he ever promised to come back. The very theologians, because these things don't make sense to their understanding and ability to explain other than God will perform it. It's the pride of man to say, if I can't explain it, it can't happen. I can't explain everything God can do other than that God is all-powerful and able to accomplish every word that he says. He says it will not come back to him void. If he says he will do it, it will be accomplished. And it may be outside of my understanding, but I can believe it because I can't know all those things that God knows. The scientists who scoff the loudest about the notion of a virgin birth. How can a woman have a child if she was a virgin? It's impossible. They laugh about it. They laugh about the resurrection of the dead. But they're the very ones that say man spontaneously sprang up from a sterile, inorganic material and developed into man. Now, there's a contradiction there. I can't believe in a virgin birth from a human woman, but I think an inanimate, unalive piece of stone turned into a moss that washed up into a beach, it's now me. It's a theory because they have no other explanation. I'm going to read in Colossians chapter 2, verse 8. The New Testament time. They were dealing with these things. Here Paul says, beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceits after the traditions of men, after the rudiments of the world, and not after Christ. This is the plan of Satan. Spoil you with philosophy. Philosophy here comes from a Greek word, two words, philo, which means love, and sophia, which means learning. Sophia means knowledge or learning. So it's the love of learning. Don't let men spoil you. through this idea that you have to know everything, that you have to be able to explain everything, or through these vain deceits, which means empty round of lies that do not bring you to God. Don't let those deceive you. Don't let those come against you. Paul, he told the Philippians, he says, beware of evil workers, beware of concisions. Philippians chapter 3, verses 2 and 3. He says, beware of concision, which means to cut away, to mutilate the truth. Which worship, he says, we are to worship God in the Spirit. Don't let men cut away or mutilate the truth of the doctrine of Jesus Christ, the gospel, and make you fall away from it, to leave it, to depart it, to deny it, to question it. There is a plan of salvation that is there. It's set before us. It has not to deal with these scientific principles. Jesus told the woman at the well, he says, the day will come that those who worship me will worship me in spirit and in truth. That's how we have to worship God. It's not through the scientific explanations of God. It's through the Spirit and the truths. There is a plan of salvation. The plan of salvation is through Jesus Christ and believing upon Him. Baptism, remission of your sins, endurance to the end. Those things are what's required of us. And they're not scientific explanations. They're faith in one God and the ability to complete these things. Peter and Jude, they both told us, the last days men will be walking after their own lust. There will be scoffers in the last days. They will pull men away. And they'll ask, where is the promise of their coming? And he says, these are unlearned men because they're not understanding the truth. And it says, They wrestle with these things of science, and they wrestle with the Word of God, and that wrestling with the Word of God is to their own destruction. It will destroy them. We need to learn. We need to learn science. I say hooray for more science classes in school. But what is its relationship to God? You know, Michelle started uploading sermons to the internet. And Bobby suggested to her that she put a topic sentence on there for every one of these sermons. And last time I preached, you know, she got me and said, okay, now tell me what your topic sentence is. You know, well, gosh, you know. You know, if I preach a sermon, I ought to be able to tell you what the topic of it was. If I don't know, how are you going to know? And so I started thinking about it, you know, on this sermon. You know, before she hit me up, I started thinking about what would describe this sentence in this sermon in a nutshell? And if I put this sermon in a nutshell, Michelle, write this down. I'm not going to tell you again. Topic sentence. God created man. He created imagination and science. But it is not defined, but he is not defined or confined to them. Take care not to let man or his imagination and his feeble efforts of understanding science cause you to slip through the fingers of God's plan of salvation. Use it or lose it. Don't let these things let you slip through the plan of salvation. He holds you in his hand. But science can create a hole big enough for you to go through. Are you going to go through it? I'm going to use science. I'm going to put a man through this card. Who wants to do it? Jay says he can do it. You can do it, Zach? You can cut the hole so I can go through this card? Huh? You'll cut the hole? Okay, cut me a hole that I can go through. Cut me a hole in this card that I can put you through. Do whatever you want. It's getting late. I think I'm going to put you through it.